Welcome to African American Conservative, your source for political news and commentary from a cultural and right-of-center perspective. African American Conservative, the soul of the conservative movement. Good evening, and welcome to African American Conservatives. This is your host, Marie Strotter. Tonight, we have Ana Quintana. She will be discussing Cuba and some other issues, along with election 2016, as they relate to Cuban Americans and other issues of the day. This was taped before Senator Marco Rubio suspended his campaign, so you may hear us allude to his campaign. Ana Quintana is a policy analyst for Latin America and the Western Hemisphere in the Heritage Foundation's Allison Center for Foreign and National Security Policy Studies. Welcome to the show, Ana.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Not long after Barack Obama came into office, it was evident that he intended to keep his promise to fundamentally change our nation, including our foreign policy. But even so, many were surprised by the passion with which our president responded to the removal from office of Honduran President Manuel Zelaya. Since President Zelaya's removal was done under Honduran law and was supported by both the Honduran Congress and the Honduran Supreme Court, few expected President Obama to try to twist Honduras's arm on the matter by attempting to suspend military aid to the nation until they restored President Zelaya. Looking back, however, should we have known from President Obama's support for a man known for his alliances with figures like Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro, as he was for his cowboy hats, that our president's views on the Central American socialism were so friendly that outreach to Cuba was inevitable?
I mean, I think nobody truly expected just how fundamentally radical the president's foreign policy views would be, right? I mean, I was extremely surprised at how the administration responded to the constitutional crisis in Honduras. You know, I was into Honduras in 2013 for that, you know, for their elections then. And I mean, even then, you could still feel the hostility from our embassy and from our, you know, our diplomats towards the Honduras, the newly elected Honduran government, the conservative government, rather. So I kind of think it's overall just largely indicative of this revisionist worldview that they have, right? Of as anything semi, you know, related towards the right wing as being something negative, and as them having to kind of support this leftist movement as, because it's the underdog, right? It's kind of that struggle that they need to naturally align themselves with. But as towards Cuba, I'm a first-generation Cuban-American, and I never in my entire lifetime ever imagined seeing what I'm seeing now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. President Zelaya also sought to ally Honduras with ALBA, an organization you say is of Latin American countries who are, quote, all governed by authoritarians in the mold of Castro, end quote. How much influence does ALBA give the Castros, and how do they use this influence?
Well, it's rather the influence that Castro gives ALBA. So the ALBA is the Bolivarian Alliance, and this was created by the now deceased Hugo Chavez. And it's this regional bloc of countries led by these authoritarian populists who have all been legally elected, right? Like, they've been democratically elected, but that's where the legality stops. It's once they become democratically elected, then they just become these, they start radically transforming their countries to to very heavy executive type power systems, right? Their constitutions are radically altered. It's I mean, look how long Hugo Chavez stayed in power for over a decade, because he radically, like, he essentially stole elections, you know, changed the constitution at however, you know, it sought to suit him. And that's kind of what the model that they exported, you know, this one-party dictatorship model that they exported throughout Latin America. And what's the one thing that these countries all have in common? It's anti-Americanism, right? They've all been extremely hostile to U.S. interests. And kind of the leader in all of this, right, like the ideological kind of guide has been the Castro regime. You know, when Hugo Chavez, when he attempted a coup in 1992, when he was imprisoned afterwards, this is when he was a military officer, he always said Fidel Castro was his mentor. Fidel Castro was who he sought for any sort of, you know, for teachings, for kind of like how they should bring what they called the 21st century socialism to Latin America.
One of the frequent criticisms of the Obama foreign policy is that instead of tough give-and-take negotiations, it engages in give-and-give-and-give some negotiations. We negotiated a deal with Iran, for example, that gave them approximately $150 billion and a pathway to nuclear weapons. And in return, we do not even win the release of Americans held hostage by them. Did the White House similarly leave possible concessions on the table during our negotiations with Cuba to reestablish diplomatic relations? If so, what were they?
Oh, I mean, the entire Cuba normalization process has been nothing but a set of unilateral concessions, right? So we, prior to the announcement on December 17th of 2014, there were supposed negotiations having been going on for 18 months. In these entire 18 months, the only thing that we were able to get was Alan Gross, who is a U.S. hostage who was held in Cuba. He'd been held there for 5 years. He was literally at the point of death. That is the only thing that we got. And in return, we gave up the three remaining members of this spy network that was arrested in the United States. I was arrested and, you know, and convicted of espionage here in the United States. Aside from that, it was, and that's when the, you know, concessions continued rolling in. You have the White House actively lobbying Congress to prematurely lift the embargo, despite the fact that the Cuban government has not met the terms of lifting the embargo. I mean, the law is the law, and the president cannot selectively choose when he can and should apply the law. You have the president via executive action, because Congress is obviously saying, you know, Cuban government hasn't met these terms, so we're not going to lift the embargo. So you have the president via executive action doing anything he can do to undermine existing law. I mean, he's created these avenues for commercial opportunities for the Cuban government that are absolutely ridiculous. I mean, the embassy opening, the Cuban government should not, it's been contested that it is illegal for the embassy to have even been opened up, because, again, the Cuban government does not meet the terms to have an embassy in the United States, nor should we have upgraded our diplomatic presence on the island to be an embassy as well. There's many countries that we have very tense diplomatic relations with that we don't have an embassy, nor do we give them the, you know, the great luxury of having an ambassador here to the U.S. This entire situation has been literally a set of these unilateral concessions, and now that's exactly what President Obama's trip to the island, you know, this month is going to be. It's going to be kind of like that symbolic cherry on top for the Cuban government.
You wrote, quote, "Part of the problem of Obama's new Cuban policy is that it ignores the Castro regime's long, sad history of violence, murder, and poverty as tools of repression. While Obama may be able to sweep that under the rug, generations of exiles and their sons and daughters, myself included, will continue to demand the justice due," end quote. Would you remind us of the forgotten history of the human rights crimes of the Castro regime?
I mean, it's not even history. It's just this past Sunday alone, it's been the 44th Sunday in a row that the Cuban government has cracked down on human rights activists. You know, every Sunday, the ladies in white, they march, and these are peaceful protesters. These are nonviolent, peaceful protesters who march either before mass or after mass, you know, to advocate for simple human rights on the island, like things like the freedom of speech or, you know, to have elections, something that Cuba has not seen in three generations in over half a century. And the Cuban government violently cracks down on them, throws them in prison, beats them up. And this is them going light. I mean, in the times of right after the revolution and, you know, throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I mean, there were government-sponsored death squads that used to kill people. And one person whose book I think is, who I think people should know a lot more about is Ambassador Armando Valladares. He was Reagan's ambassador to the UN Human Rights Commission, but he was also a political prisoner in Cuba. He was held there for about two decades. And he wrote his memoirs by sneaking scraps of paper out of prison. And the only reason he was imprisoned was because he was a Catholic and refused to put some communist insignia on his desk because it violated his beliefs. So the guards used to break his bones and urinate on him and defecate on him. And this man, he only survived because of his faith. And he, you know, he's still around. He's about 80-something years old. And he still talks about his experiences. And he's somebody who's been a large advocate against of what the president is doing. I mean, he's been very against what the president has been doing.
You mentioned a dissident named Jorge Luis Garcia. And
yes,
he is considered Cuba's Nelson Mandela.
Yes.
Would you tell us more about him and his legacy?
Oh my God, he is an Afro-Cuban dissident, as is his wife, Ira Edis, and I've had the pleasure of meeting them both on many occasions. And so he spent about 17 years in prison. And so the first time that I visited Cuba, the only time I visited Cuba, was around the time that he actually got out of prison. We talked about that once. It was like a really weird coincidence. He's a dissident leader, and he's a staunch human rights activist. He was Speaker Boehner's guest to the State of the Union last year. And I mean, he is one of the strongest and most determined, you know, democracy figures that has walked this earth. I mean, this man and his wife literally get beaten on. They get their house is routinely ransacked and their belongings are broken. His computer has been confiscated I don't know how many times. And yet he continues coming to the United States whenever he can, meeting with members of Congress and teaching them, listen, these are the true ways of the Cuban government. They cannot be trusted, and what your president is doing is radically dangerous. I mean, for those who don't know about him, his name, he goes by Antunes. I mean, he is definitely somebody that we should be admiring.
Wow. Secretary Kerry recently announced the cancellation of a planned March 21st trip to Cuba, partly due to Cuba's unwillingness to allow him to meet with human rights dissidents. Would there have been any substantial benefit to the Cuban rights cause had that meeting been allowed, in your opinion? If not, why do you believe Cuba has thus far so adamantly opposed it?
I mean, Kerry's cancellation of his visit means absolutely nothing because he's going down now with Obama in these next coming weeks. I mean, it's incredible to think that they now think that over a year later that they can start bringing human rights to the table. The Cuban government has pretty much gotten all that they wanted, right? The Cuban government was never going to improve their condition, their human rights conditions, had they not been coerced to do so, right? I've never in the history of any country or any dictatorship has a dictatorship ever been brought down, or have they improved their behavior on diplomatic and commercial concessions. It simply does not exist. And I mean, Kerry could have done so when the embassy opened, for example. During the embassy launch, he specifically did not allow for any Cuban dissidents or human rights activists to be at the American embassy, which is sovereign American territory, not Cuban territory. It's American territory. He didn't allow any of them to be there because he said he didn't want to antagonize the Cuban government. And instead, he had a private meeting with, you know, private off-the-record meeting with certain dissidents. And now, I mean, clearly the Cuban government was never going to allow something like that. And at this point, you know, it's a little too late. I mean, the dissidents feel slighted, and they're going to remember this.
Mm-hmm. Many in the Cuban-American community especially are welcoming the lifting of the travel ban, as many have spent years longing for the opportunity to visit parents, grandparents, siblings, even spouses left behind in Cuba. You seem skeptical that this will come to be. Why so?
I mean, the travel ban for Cuban Americans there's never really been a travel ban up until 2009. President Obama completely lifted the travel ban for Cuban American citizens, right? So I mean, for Americans of Cuban descent. So me, as of 2009, I could go back and forth to Cuba whenever I wanted. But the fact is that the problem that's been created is that, so look, my family left the island and has never returned because they left with a credible fear of the government. And what you are seeing now, especially with the Cubans who are coming over, they're not coming over as political refugees. They're coming over as, you know, economic refugees, the same that you have coming from other countries looking for economic opportunities because, you know, less than a year later, they're cashing their Social Security checks here in the United States and returning back to the island. That, in turn, helps prop up the Cuban regime. You're not seeing the politically active Cubans like you used to see before, which is extremely unfortunate, you know, and it's a product of 3 decades of living under, you know, communism that you don't expect things to change because the perpetuity of the Cuban the Castro regime seems, I mean, think of how many people they've outlived. They've practically outlived every adversary they ever had. So I don't necessarily see the benefit to, I mean, for Cuban Americans traveling back and forth as tourists to Cuba, that's not purposeful travel. I think that's exploitative, and that's just continuing, that's propping up the Cuban government.
You wrote, quote, "In trying to be progressive, the White House is actually taking bilateral relations, replicating the relationship between the United States and Cuba in the 1950s, end quote. Why would such a replication be a negative thing in your view, and how could such a replication be avoided?
Well, I mean, it's negative because every commercial opening that we've done right now, every weakening of the trade embargo that we've done, directly benefits the Cuban government. There is no such thing as free trade between a foreign entity like a U.S. company and individual Cuban citizens. Everything is done. The Cuban government, via the Cuban military, controls and operates the Cuban economy. So, and, you know, it's this idea that the Obama administration is trying to pawn off as though, you know, dictator down economics, right? As though the dictator will allow empowerment of the Cuban people and will allow, you know, will allow them to accumulate wealth. It simply won't happen. I mean, you have to be, it's, you know, becoming any sort of, I guess, economically prosperous in Cuba is not a right. It's a privilege, and it's only a privilege that's bestowed upon the most obedient and the most, I mean, the people who are not going to cause a problem for the Cuban government. You're never going to see dissidents like Jorge Luis Antunes as you know, a cab driver, for example, or someone who's working in a hotel. It's absolutely non-existent. The government will never allow it.
In some ways, President Obama's argument against Cuban sanctions, quote, "We know from hard-learned experience that it is better to encourage and support reform than to impose policies that will render a country a failed state. We should not allow U.S. sanctions to add to the burden of Cuban citizens we seek to help," end quote, is similar to the arguments used by conservatives against South African sanctions decades ago. Then we saw students shutting down universities for doing business with South Africa. We saw the media celebrating musicians for recording songs like "Ain't Gonna Play Sun City." And we saw great leaders like Reagan or Thatcher demonized. Why was engagement rather than sanctions considered racist in dealing with South African apartheid, but is being lauded by many from the same circles in response to Cuba? Are the human rights plights of the South African blacks and the Cuban dissidents so different, or is this distinction a bit hypocritical?
Oh, it's completely hypocritical. I think it goes back to the duplicity of progressives and of the left's, you know, view of human rights. Let's take, I don't know, Senator Leahy, for example, right? Senator Leahy has a law named after him called the Leahy Law, which forbids the U.S. government from financing or supporting directly any foreign military that's ever been accused or even suspected, right, of having committed a human rights violation. Leahy was one of the largest advocates for demonizing the Honduran government after the constitutional crisis in 2009 with Mel Zelaya. Yet he is one of the largest advocates for restoring diplomatic relations with the Cuban government, the Western Hemisphere's longest-running military dictatorship, right? Mm-hmm. It literally makes absolutely no sense. So honestly, it's something that I think will baffle me for the rest of my life, how they're able to make this, I don't know, this logical leap as to what's right and what's wrong. But I think human rights violations are human rights violations regardless of wherever they occur. And I think the United States, we are in a position where we should be able to, you know, wherever our national interest is not threatened, that we should be able to advocate for human rights and be able to punish governments that commit such that have such an atrocious record. And what we're doing with Cuba is we're literally whitewashing their records.
We recently read a report that Venezuela, a nation formerly considered one of Latin America's most affluent, has suddenly run out of food. That this has occurred less than 20 years after the rise of power by Hugo Chavez, and Venezuela remains the home of one of the world's richest women, Maria Gabriela Chavez, daughter of Hugo Chavez, seems telling. You said that the next president should prepare for a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela, writing that, quote, there is little doubt that Venezuela is a powder keg and that the looming crisis will have far-reaching implications for the Western Hemisphere, end quote. Would you expand upon what this looming crisis is and how we should prepare for it?
Oh, no, without a doubt. So if we look at Venezuela, right, so Venezuela is facing a series of crises, right, an economic crisis, a political crisis, and a security crisis. So inflation last year in Venezuela, inflation last year hit at about 270-something percent. It's expected this year to hit at 700-some-odd percent. The IMF is anticipating that their economy is going to contract by over 10% this year alone. The Heritage Foundation, along with the Wall Street Journal, publishes what's called the Index of Economic Freedom. Venezuela right now has dropped. It's the country that in the 21 years that we've had the index has dropped the most from a score of 60 to 33.7. I mean, it's right now ranked at 174. Zimbabwe is actually beating it. Zimbabwe economically is doing much better. And it's only on top of Cuba, North Korea. Exactly. I mean, this is a country that used to be the Saudi Arabia of Latin America, right? So you have their entire economy is largely dominated by oil. Oil makes up 95% of their GDP. Oil exports, rather, make up 95% of their GDP. Their oil industry, which is, you know, run by the state and run by, you know, Socialist Party cronies, it's literally bleeding money. The government has to print money in order to keep their oil company running. And if you look at the security situation, it has the second highest murder rate in the entire world. I mean, you're more likely to get kidnapped in Venezuela than you are to be kidnapped in Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, and God, I forgot what other. I mean, like active war zones are safer in terms of kidnapping than Venezuela is. And then politically, the Socialist Party is politically bankrupt. I mean, just last December, for the first time in 18 years, they lost lost control of the National Assembly. And this is them with having stolen. They steal elections. They literally completely stuff ballot boxes. Even with them having full control of that, they lost the National Assembly. So now you see this power battle between the National Assembly that's run by a Democratic coalition versus the Socialist Party, which is not willing to relinquish control. You know, you have dissidents and, you know, very high-ranking political figures in prison, Leopoldo López. He's been in prison for over 2 years. And now with the outbreak of the Zika virus, I mean, it's everything. And then also the country is probably going to default upon an $11 billion foreign debt payment that's due this year. I mean, it's all these things that are going on. It's the country is literally going to explode at any moment.
Judging by your Twitter feed, we are in agreement in hoping that our next president will be a Cuban-American, even if we disagree on whether he should be of full or half Cuban descent. But even if neither is successful in succeeding President Obama, you call for a very different approach to Cuba by the next administration, writing, quote, our future president must recognize that freedom doesn't flow from normalizing relations with a dictatorship. It flows when the seeds of political change sprout and are then properly nourished, end quote. Should there be no softening of our relationship with Cuba as long as the Castro regime is intact then? Or is there a list of concessions that the Castros could make short of abdicating power that would make normalizing relationships with them acceptable in your view?
I mean, I think we need to be pragmatic in this, because I've heard a lot of the candidates say that the United States needs to roll back and we need to completely undo every bit of normalization. I mean, we know how the government works. We know that once a government plan or program or initiative starts, it's very impossible to dial it back. I think we need to be extremely pragmatic and recognize, you know, we're in a new era of U.S.-Cuba relations, but I think what we need to do is we need to definitely have some preconditions put in place. The Cuban government, mm-hmm. for example, the Cuban government needs to free its political prisoners. There's no reason mm-hmm. why in the year 2016, a country in the Western Hemisphere should still have people imprisoned simply because of their beliefs. That's mm-hmm. absolutely, that should not be allowed. The Cuban government needs to stop its destruction of churches. That is a very common practice mm-hmm. the Cuban government does with churches. I mean, Christian Science Monitor has been taking all of this into account and has seen that just this year alone, the crackdown against the religious community, they're not even the anti-Castro community, they're simply communities of faith, has been extraordinary. So, I mean, there's various things that we can do that we're not doing. Instead, what we're doing is just fully abdicating control of our policy towards Cuba to business interests here in the United States, like the Chamber of Commerce, and essentially to the Cuban government.
To be fair, we should point out that it is not just the left who support President Obama's Cuba opening. Donald Trump, currently the leading Republican candidate for the presidential nomination, also supports it. And Libertarian Senator Rand Paul asks, quote, "The United States trades and engages with other communist nations, such as China and Vietnam, so why not Cuba?" End quote. So, why not Cuba?
I mean, the United States does not have a cookie-cutter foreign policy. The United States, our approach to Venezuela is not the same as our approach to Ecuador, despite the fact that they're so close to each other. So that argument right there is a non-starter. I mean, the United States needs to weigh our national interests and weigh it upon the principles that we as a country wish to promote. I mean, in countries like Saudi Arabia, for example, we unfortunately are beholden to a greater national interest that we can't advocate for greater freedoms for women like we would like to, and it's extremely unfortunate, and it's always a terrible thing when we have to do that. But in a country like Cuba is not China. Our opening up with China and our normalization with China was it was in the middle of the Cold War, and it was to exploit the divide between China and the Soviet Union. I mean, imagine a world in which China and the Soviet Union would have been allies in the Cold War. It wouldn't have ended the way that it did. But that's a clear fact. And we clearly have seen who has been suffering through all of this in China, right? China's dissident community, China's, you know, human rights activists, China's religious community. There hasn't been any greater freedoms for them. So why are we going to make that same mistake in Cuba, a country that is not an economic powerhouse, a country that, I mean, is not a nuclear armed state? There's so many things that Cuba does not have that China does. So for any individual, he's not a candidate anymore, so we can criticize it. I mean, right, Senator Paul is mistaken on this. We can't have this cookie-cutter approach. It's like, oh, we trade with one communist country, we should trade with them all. That's not the way that it goes. And again, for many people who don't know, the Western Hemisphere, right, every country in the Western Hemisphere, Cuba excluded, decided decades ago that democracy and the basic protection of human rights, like freedom of speech, freedom for elections, I mean, that's the way forward. It's these basic norms. You're never going to see that within the Middle East. You're never going to see that in any other hemisphere in the entire world. And Cuba is the only country that hasn't changed its ways to fit into the norm. So why should the United States be the one to change?
Exactly. If you're just joining us, our guest this segment has been Ana Quintana. Ana, what's next for you, and how can we continue to follow your work?
I mean, so right now I'm working on, it's thankfully there's a lot of job security in the sense that there's always issues going on in Latin America. I mean, it's incredible. It's sad, but there's a lot of work to be done, and there's a lot that we feel the administration is ignoring. I mean, Colombia is finalizing its peace talks with the terrorist group, the FARC, and it appears that the Colombian government is granting one too many concessions to the FARC and allowing them to have amnesty for things like drug trafficking and recruitment of child soldiers and whatnot. So, I mean, and the implications for the United States are significant. They're considered a foreign terrorist organization by us. So I think we need to kind of see how that's going to play out. Venezuela is obviously, you know, a continuing threat. And, I mean, Central America, the crisis in Central America that brought the unaccompanied minors to our border, you know, 2 years ago, that's not ending. And that's something I think we haven't adequately addressed.
And we can follow you on?
On Twitter, yes. Anna underscore R underscore Quintana, Quintna, and my work is published on heritage.org.
Excellent. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thanks for having me.
Unfortunately, we promised you Dr. Barry Latzer tonight, and we are having problems with the audio. We will fix this immediately and append it to the podcast when it pushes out onto iTunes. But for the live portion tonight, this ends our show. Go and enjoy the returns as they pour in tonight, and tune back to the podcast when it pushes out onto iTunes. Or while you're there, subscribe for free, and you will get it as it pushes out. This is Marie Strotter bidding you good night on this Election Return Night Tuesday. Take care and good night.
Thank you for joining African American Conservatives, the soul of the conservative movement. Please join us at www.AfricanAmericanConservatives.com. There you'll find information about our Twitter feed, Facebook page, and our blog. All opinions expressed here are those of this show and our guests. Copyright African American Conservatives.